If you look closely at the map of Bangladesh, it is almost entirely surrounded by India. A journalist said to me that it looked like the suspended fetus of India, about to drop into the Bay of Bengal. I bristled at the insult, but it was a formal event, so I stayed polite. In Goodnight, Mr. Kissinger, Qazi Anis Ahmed imagines a similarly polite Bengali waiter encountering an upscale surprise guest at a New York restaurant. "What is your name?" Mr. Kissinger asked me with slight bemusement. "James, sir, James Da Costa." "Where are you from?" "Bangladesh, sir." "A James from Bangladesh, an unlikely name for a Bangladeshi, isn't it?" "It's an unlikely country, sir," I replied, as I swept away the crumbs from the thick white tablecloth. When I brought the check to Kissinger, he asked me, "So how is your unlikely country doing these days?" "Quite well, sir," I replied. "It can't be doing that well if you are here, can it? How long have you been in America?" "Just 2 years, sir." "I hope your country isn't still a basket case for the sake of those who are stuck there," said Mr. Kissinger, as he wrote a fat sum for the tip. Back to that map. There is a tiny sliver of a border with Burma. But in spite of Buddhist-Muslim tensions across the border, the country does not have a great hold over our national imagination. As a joke goes in military circles, if Burma ever wanted to invade Bangladesh, their soldiers would have to march single file. Gallows humor. The enemy will not invade us because it's not worth the trouble. For countries that struggle with defining their space on South Asia's fragmented map, foundational stories are crucial. Pakistan exists because India was not enough, so partition had to happen. Bangladesh exists because Pakistan wasn't enough, so a second partition happened in 1971. But actually, the first partition of India happened in 1905, when the British split Bengal based on religion. The Hindu majority area became West Bengal, in today's India, and the Muslim majority area became East Bengal, what then became East Pakistan and even later Bangladesh. Salman Rushdie called us midnight's children, but actually we are children of 1905, still struggling with the idea that religion should or should not be the defining characteristic of where neighbors become strangers. In Goscinny Uderzo's Asterix and the Great Divide, the dividing line is a source of humor and plot line. A symbolic home that has a bordering canal right down the middle. At the end of the story, Asterix has a toast, Obelix eats a whole boar, and star-crossed lovers unite across the border. Very French. But that hopeful utopia does not approach the reality on the ground in South Asia. A much more relevant rendering of that same story was Sadat Hasan Manto's Toba Tek Singh. The story is set in an asylum, where the governments of India and Pakistan decided to exchange Muslim, Sikh, and Hindu prisoners across the 1947 borders. Bishan Singh is a Sikh inmate of the Lahore asylum. When he gets irritated, he shouts a mix of Punjabi, Urdu, and English. Upar di Gurgur, the annex di Bidhiana, the Mung di Dal of the Pakistan and Hindustan of the Dur Pitiye Mun, which means the inattention of the annex of the rumbling upstairs of the Mung Dal of the Pakistan and India of the go to bloody hell. When he is told his hometown Toba Tek Singh is now in Pakistan, he lies down between the barbed wire fences. There behind barbed wire was Hindustan. Here behind the same kind of barbed wire was Pakistan. In between, on that piece of ground that had no name, lay Toba Tek Singh. Humayun Azad, though not starting out in an asylum, is perhaps driven gradually mad by what he witnesses after the third partition. In a 2003 essay, Amra Ki Ei Bangladesh Cheyechhilam, or Is This the Bangladesh We Wanted, he reminds those doubtful of why this country exists, what would have happened if the country did not exist? What would happen if in 1971, religion had prevailed as a unifying force and Pakistan had stayed unbroken? Our fathers committed a deadly mistake, a crime. They made Bengal into Pakistan. We did not want to stay sons of slaves, so we created Bangladesh. Now let us imagine Bangladesh never became independent. We were still East Pakistan. What would we see around us? We would see the flag with moon and stars. We would hear Pak Sar Zameen Saad Baad. Urdu would be spoken everywhere. The cinema hall would be showing Bahana and Banjaran. The president would be some Punjabi. The army, from major to brigadier to general, would be filled with Pathans and Punjabis. The millionaires would all be Pakistani. The roads would be filled with laughing Sindhis in their jeeps. Those who roar around in Pajeros today, they would be standing on the roadside, shaking in front of those same jeeps. The Adamjis, the Dauds, the Bawanis, and Kabuliwalas would run this country. We would be happy to lick the dust off their feet. And that is why Azad concluded, there can be no question of going back to Pakistan or going back to religion as the basis for national identity or national politics. But in the changed environment after the 1980s, religious identity and religious politics revived in Bangladesh. Azad soon became an inconvenient Cassandra. As the country's most prominent atheist and a best-selling author, he received death threats from fringe Islamist groups. No one took these things seriously, until, of course, someone did. I last saw him at the annual Ekushe Book Fair in 2002. He was chain-smoking and signing his books. I introduced myself, and after I explained that I wrote mostly in English, he seemed to lose interest. 2 years later, at that same book fair, assailants attacked him as he was leaving the fair. Azad survived, but multiple surgeries to save his life weakened him fatally. 6 months later, he was found dead in an apartment in Munich, where he was on a visiting fellowship. His family claimed foul play, perhaps suspecting migrants living in Germany. But I think he died of a broken heart about what Bangladesh was supposed to be and what it became and what still might lie in the future. At the time of his death, he was working on translating the works of Heinrich Heine. So what does lie ahead 20 years from now? This seems to be the moment to pause and think of this, as the Arab Spring has ushered in Islamist regimes in many countries, to the abiding surprise of those in the Muslim world who imagined that this revolutionary moment would be one of post-religious politics. I want to borrow from the title of Vijay Prashad's book, Arab Spring, Libyan Winter, and suggest that it was both an Arab Spring and now a cold, long, hard winter. There are new equations in Egypt, Libya, Morocco, Syria, and everywhere we see Islamists on the ascendance. Almost everywhere. A specter has haunted Bangladesh as well for 4 decades, and that is the possibility of an Islamist government. The scenario of an Islamist party coming to power, either through democracy or through extra-constitutional violence, has been the bête noire of national discourse since the 1980s. In the process, discussions about Islam as a political force and Islam as social practice have become intertwined in an obfuscating manner. But those who oppose Islamist politics will respond to such comments by insisting that a flattening of discourse is essential to win an upper hand in national politics. From such a vantage point, attempts at teasing out nuance, complexity, practice, etc., within the space of Islamist politics, especially as it meets with practice, is met with derision. The recent debate over rising Islamist politics in spring 2013 generated many such moments. Blogger Mahmoud Mohamed Morshed commented on the analysis presented by a leftist intellectual. He wrote, "Buddhijibira jokhon Laka, Foucault, McLuhan, Said, Assad koren, tokhon tader to mohageni mone hoy. Kintu ghotoban bishoy niye jokhon kotha bolen, tokhon mone hoy enara kandoganer khetre primaryo par hoyte paren nai." Or translated, "Our academics seem to be masters at digesting Laka, Foucault, McLuhan, Said, Assad, etc. But when they turn that lens to contemporary events, they speak like a first grade student." It reminds me then of this moment, when I confront a possible future where the left would indeed be in permanent decline and we would see the Islamist moment in Bangladesh at last. Every time I photograph a protest rally, there are bits I'm leaving out, right at the edge of the lens, beyond the flare zone, a new rule of thirds, exaggeration and omission. No matter what size the event, I'll be writing to the newspapers afterwards, the New York Times or the Bangladesh Daily Star, insisting that there were 100,000 marchers on that day. On this day, January 5th, there are two parallel rallies in Dhaka, both protesting overseas wars. The one on the university campus, organized by my friends and allies, the Left Student Union, the Student Unity Front, the art school graduates. The rally ends, as always, with the ritual burning of the effigy. The words written on top of the straw figure have not changed much in 3 decades. There are still warmongers, still imperialism. After the fire goes out, we let the rickshaws start coming into the university area again. Soon traffic is back to its usual chaotic mess. The second rally of that Friday was much bigger and more intense. In this one, I could find no friends, except among the photographers. Organized by one of the newer Islamist groups, and here again the obligatory quote marks around Islamist to insist yet again that this is not spirituality but politics. A group with a cocktail mixture of religion, Khilafat, and traditional left targets. World Bank, IMF, coal mining, multinationals. Demanding the withdrawal of Bangladeshi soldiers from UN peacekeeping missions, it built on rumors of a future multinational force in Iraq led by Bangladesh or Pakistan. Whether it would happen or not is almost besides the point. The intention is to resist, and loudly. The appeal of this new politics is seductive. These are not the Islamists we lampooned in the 1980s. A sharp reality edge has now come into their rhetoric. When they say that gangster capitalism has failed and is dragging down the world with it, that Western values are imploding inside their own contradictions, it's a resonant message for the street and for many. I heard the same message at the other rally as well. Imperialism, United Nations, multinationals. Say no to big coal. All the same targets. But images of Che in the first rally, an Arabic script with Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim in this one. Is the difference now only in icons? These boys look very similar to the groups that hang out in all my favorite spots. Dhanmundi Cafe Mango, Elephant Road, Kolabagan, Dhaka University, Boshundhara City Mall. The same sideburns, sunglasses, lowrider jeans, mobile phones. Weaving in and out of the crowd, photographing the men in these protests, I'm thinking of other men in other times. Almost 30 years back now, or perhaps 30 years in the future, angry, idealistic, and frustrated. Those who survived the jails and the manhunts are much older now. When I talk to them, they're always going on about failed dreams. Some argue the historic moment was not right. Others blame their organizational weaknesses. We didn't study enough Marx and Lenin. We never understood dialectic materialism, whatever that means. Always men, slightly broken, talking about the what-if moment of the last century. Iran 2008, Turkey 2013. We have been here before, and yet every time we hope against hope. When the Iranian Green Revolution happened, I was so sure that this was it. And I know I'll keep thinking this is it, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, 30 years from now. Always, the moment has arrived. It begins with energy. Many coordinated moments. Everyone believes again they will make history. The last slow motions of a woman jittering as the blood seeps out, and the camera insists on staying and recording. A lonely blog claims that the photo circulating is a different Neda. This Neda is still alive. Is it true? Months later, I'm still seeing that mistake on placards. As demonstrators stay on the street, the world is synchronized briefly. In Dhaka, we do graffiti action on the Iranian Cultural Center. Miraculously, there are no guards, the only witness, a sleepy night watchman. Tempers flare quickly at a rally on Dhaka University campus. Chavez's endorsement of the election results works like black magic. Leftists tie themselves into knots to defend the impossible. An optimistic editorial, the revolution will bypass your filters. Later, all this seems too much hope as the state stifles voices one by one, as they've done before, as they will do again. No more shouting from night dark rooftops. Now the Revolutionary Guard emerges with more power, the Basij at the sharp edge. I'm thinking of the Banlieue riots that helped propel to power the same French politician who called those rioters scum. In 1978, Michel Foucault was seduced by an Ayatollah's steely determination to discipline and punish. In contrast, Gilles Perez was not won over. He calmly photographed and collected. Later, he excavated the telex, urgent messages from the Paris news agency, with ever more requests. Please send more photos of black chador, women, communists. Please, more now. The philosopher predicted the birth of ideas. The photographer saw things carried out in the name of revolution. 2009. Mary Walling Blackburn. We meet at last, the two of us in New York. More rallies, trying to muster up energy for us and others. But we worry. The scene is set, a flag to bolster spirits. But things feel like a shadow play, never quite ending. Every gathering with a foretold script. The security barriers mark a neutered zone for dissent. Finally, though, there is this one day in Brooklyn. The air is traversed, and the marchers walk from one bank to another. It isn't a miracle, but it is beautiful. X number of women and men for X hours holding a green banner. No fists, no barbed wire, no peace symbol. Distance rescues it from exhausted protest imagery. another bridge, my camera records the march. A mile of air and water covered by the zoom lens. How near do we want to be? Some are breaking apart because they are not closer. Some are breaking apart because they're in the quake center. All are texting each other, phone to phone, as if there were no ocean between. SMS messages run alongside with them. They're buoyed by love from home, anchored to essential routines, where to eat lunch and where to hang out. They're against a dictatorship, and they're very, very normal. These messages are the interior of a movement, made sonic. Text moving from hand to eye to hand to eye through air and water. Remember, there's still the solo cameraman on the other bridge. From the outside, it's a lonesome kind of protest. We talk for a few moments. He is feeling slightly forlorn. There are no texts in Farsi feeding through his phone because he is not from Iran. Maybe, I advise, you can borrow some later from a neighbor. There are many inside Bangladesh now that consider the Islamists to be the new subaltern. Their class composition may be so, but I cannot find a progressive project within a set of demands that suggest gender segregation as a path to female emancipation. So women will still work in garments factories, but there will be all women factories with no men anywhere. Sultana's dream again, but this time in the form of dystopia, yoked to a socially conservative project. I look at the images of Turkey and imagine this is how it will happen in the end for Bangladesh as well. 30 years from now, first there will be an Islamist party. They will stay in power for a long time. They will exhaust the storehouse of piety. From within that moment will emerge a revived left. The problem is, and this is the disheartening part, we have to weather that period as well to get to the other politics, to get to the other side. Emrah Yildiz writes in Jadalia, as we all well know, the secularist Islamist divide has paralyzed the organization of political systems, let alone formations of political parties in the wider Middle East. Building on Talal Asad's work on genealogies of religion and formulations of the secular, and through his analysis of sovereignty and protest in Egypt, Hossein Ali Agrama has proposed to rethink this differentiation through an indifference to secularism and coined the Egyptian revolution an asecular one. In the sense that it stands prior to religion and politics and that it is indifferent to the question of their distinction. The bare sovereignty manifested by the protest movement stands outside the problem space of secularism. In that sense, it represents genuinely a secular power. I read those words, but I'm not really sure if I agree. Somehow, somewhere along the way, the Islamists are never embarrassed to say that there is an Islamist project, but the secularists are now embarrassed to say there is a secularist project. Somewhere in the future, there is a way to recover that project outside of this asecular space as well. Turkey is a new moment, and perhaps this moment too shall pass and we'll nurse our disappointments. Or perhaps this time we'll be surprised. I think a lot about utopia-dystopia slippage, how protests to build utopian states or communities can slip unexpectedly into their inverse. At the fulcrum is the 1970s left, which sometimes accidentally ushered in even more rightist forces than the governments they were critiquing. This is a reversal of the heroic narrative we expect in these moments. Popular uprisings do not always result in victory for the progressive forces, even if they are the vanguard. But what is the choice? Somewhere in the future, there is the possibility to still get involved, even if you think it may not work out. The optimism that is embedded within these moments, a belief that transformation was just around the corner and all it needed was a little push, that is what motivated the 1970s. In spite of the weight of history, people still join and will join dissident movements, choose modes of confrontation, and carve out emotional vectors of in the heat of the moment. For some time now, I have been thinking through and worrying that we approach moments of dissent with caution, too much caution. That hesitation is informed by earlier histories, where initial possibility was sometimes inverted into tragic outcomes. This is not to suggest that progressive movements or left movements or any movement is predestined to fail or succeed. It is against the possibility of a permanent history. But we need to allow that there are not always necessary or inevitable failures either. In spite of the disappointments, people keep joining and forming global movements in ever-increasing numbers, investing their energy and staking their future on the possibility of a transformed, egalitarian, just world. Some of us want to find that within a left politics. The challenge then is putting aside the weight of history and continuing to invest hope in new movements, in an almost impossible utopianism. What lies in then within the capacity for imagining utopia in spite of contrarian evidence? I do not know the answer. But in unmediated moments, I am with this young man in Istanbul, standing on a high roof, flashing the victory sign, and hoping for a different future. Maybe later, there will be many ifs, ands, or buts. He will turn out to be this or that. The movement will become that or this. The photographer will be accused of staging the moment. Photoshop will come into the story. The story will always change. There will always be disappointment. But in this small moment, looking at this picture, I imagine that other futures can still inspire us into action. Thank you.
Thanks, Naeem. Does anybody have a question for Naeem or something you would like to add? Go ahead.
That's the first question. Okay. I mean, I'm a Marxist, and that's where my politics first and foremost come from. In the context that I'm talking about, a left politics is, you know, class politics, and the Islamists will claim that they can also read scripture and find class politics within there. So the left politics that I think of, at least in these countries, definitely left politics that's outside of Islamist politics. And part of the struggle that's going on right now is there are portions of the left, I didn't speak about it during the talk, that are now thinking that the left needs to reinvent itself by merging with the Islamists. And I have a different project in mind. I don't have the answers yet, but somewhere class politics that can transcend the dependence on religion and religious politics as a unifying force, because it's a powerful unifying and mobilizing force right now in all of these countries. It's a singular force, and it's the singular dissident force. The left is often rendered in these moments as a tragic, always late actor. So part of the project is to get that left back. That's not a definition, but it's talking around it.
It's an alternative, and it's not like part of the existing left, because I'm Turkish and I'm from Istanbul, and I don't see any left in my country. There's no left movement per se. Even the like Marxist political party, they don't even get into parliament, and they are not leftist. I would define them as nationalists. So you're claiming that a new left will emerge potentially, maybe.
30 years from now, yes.
Yeah.
saying 30 years was not a, it's not a dodge.
So the left will redefine itself and reorient itself in the light of what has happened.
Yes, but in this context, it's also about the left coming. So, you know, part of the appeal of Islamist politics is also the rise of piety in personal and public space. So a class-based politics that we talk about, at least in Bangladesh, it has to be outside of piety, because the entire population is not Muslim, as it is not in most Muslim majority countries. But the assumption always is that the Islamists will speak for everybody. And piety doesn't matter. You'll accept this public display and then continue otherwise. The left politics that we've been talking about in Bangladesh has traditionally defined itself as also being about the absence of piety from public space and absence of its inroads into the discourse of what is and is not acceptable behavior in public, which is not just politics, but the social. It's true that if you look at the parties that have gone under the banner of the left in many of these countries, it doesn't give you much hope. But that's the whole point of a utopian impulse, is to see beyond. I mean, if I think back to the Iranian Green Movement, and if you look at, you know, that rally, the one that crossed the Brooklyn Bridge, that was the high point of pro-democracy movements in New York. And for the moment, if you stood in a certain place, if you photographed in a certain way, it would seem like there's so many possibilities. And then it withered away, like so many of these moments did. And I think part of the utopian impulse is to figure out how you can keep getting motivated, because one of the things that also happens is there's a constant turnover, I think, in who are the most active members, at least in Bangladesh, within the left, because at a certain point they say, oh, we've seen this already. I've gone through the 1970s, don't tell me about this. I'm just busy working, no more of this utopian political impulse. And so part of what many of us have been talking about is trying to figure out a way around that. And part of it is also about defining ourselves in contrast with an Islamist politics, which is very powerful right now. The two hands up.
Yeah, just say that comment that was interesting about these images of the Iranian protest across the Brooklyn Bridge being connected to a moment in New York.
Louder?
Yeah, so you just mentioned right now the connection between the 2009 protests about the Iranian elections and New York. So I'm wondering if you see this as the rise of a global left, or some sort of pan-Middle Eastern left, or is it more based on the specificities in each context? I mean, I find, like, the images of the protests from New York, I do think are problematic, in that relations between the US and Iran are not porous at all. So it's likely that a lot of the people protesting, like their connections to Iran, are in themselves possibly mythical. I mean, I think like a lot of these individuals have parents who are Iranian, but left right before or after the revolution, haven't been back. That's not to say that it's not a worthy action, or that it doesn't impact you know, the scene in Iran itself, but I do think that Iranians living in Iran, like the way that they protest and the way that they discuss Iranian politics, is very different than those of us who have the comfort of doing so from New York City. So I'm just wondering, I suppose, like, how much your view takes all of that into account, and how much it looks towards, you know, values that maybe transcend all of that, or somehow, I don't know, somehow motivate meaningful action despite those tensions.
I mean, one, when you said, just to ask a clarifying question, when you said the photographs themselves were problematic, there was only one photograph from the New York rallies, right? Because the first three were from Bangladesh. The third one, where they're holding a green banner, those are all in Dhaka. Right, so there's only one in Central Park. I mean, I just wanted to be clear on that. I mean, there's a few things going on. One is that I don't think the Iranian protest rallies in New York were that transnational, because when you spend a little bit of time, You'll find even your Iranian friends there will say, oh, but this also reflects all the schisms of various kinds, including my Iranian friends can tell, looking at the crowd, who immigrated when, and their class composition. And then there are subgroups within that. That all is there, of course. And certainly in New York and in California, it was also a reflection, first and foremost, of the Iranian community's drive to have something happen. And then everybody else came around it. For me, it has many things to unpack in there. But for me, what was interesting in that moment, which I didn't get into so much in my talk, but you know, I had a conventional idea about my left comrades, friends, people I've known, that any sort of global uprising against a reactionary government will be something we'll support. And I never really went through the process of, oh, but here is this movement that we didn't support. You just presume people didn't look at it. But the Iranian Green Uprising, when we held rallies in Bangladesh, in Dhaka, there were very hostile reactions from traditional left, partially because of Chavez, which I mentioned because he had endorsed Ahmadinejad in that moment. And that, I think, was enough for many people, or there was a confusion, there were the questions about whether the movement was being funded, etc., etc. The sort of questions that you can ask about any movement, right? Any movement can, in this interlinked world, you can ask whether any movement has some sort of support from somewhere else. And if you use that argument, you should raise that question, but it can also be a path to not doing anything. In any case, in Bangladesh, the reaction was very strong against it. And it was a very sort of discombobulating moment for me, because I thought, oh, wait, but we're all from the left, isn't this another moment where we should stand together? And it was very fractured. And then by coincidence, I happened to come to New York 2 weeks later, or came back to New York, or was in New York. And there was this rally happening. It was a very different dynamic. But actually what was interesting was, for me, this space, but that space is also about the fact that, you know, it was Iranian migrant exiles in New York protesting for Iran. So anyway, it's a very discombobulated space. So that was what I was interested in. In terms of transnational solidarity, obviously almost everything that happens now is tremendously shared through all the mediums that are in front of us. But I don't know if that's the same as solidarity, because, or it's the same as building work, because it also seems that one of the dangers of that is people move on very quickly. Like, I don't see anyone, just taking New York as an example, discuss what is or is not happening with the green movement now. Maybe there is nothing left of it. Maybe it's not worth discussing. Maybe things came out, as I said, that this was not what we thought it was, et cetera, et cetera. All of those things could be there. But the fact that nobody discusses those moments anymore brings a different thing, which is not about left politics necessarily, but the fragility of trans-border solidarity. That when you are when you're connected with many more movements than you would have been 30 years ago, your ability to stay committed to one movement also changes. Obviously, in the specific example of Iran and in Syria and many of these situations right now, transnational solidarity is actually a problem, right? Because sometimes people on the ground may actually even argue, actually, if somebody holds a rally in that place, that might be a problem. Like, it might not be a problem maybe if the rally is in Delhi or Dhaka, but it might be a problem if it's in New York. And in fact, in Dhaka, when we held the rally, there was this Iranian student, Hanif Yazdi. So the Iranian community is very tiny. I don't think more than like 500 people in the city, or less. He really wanted to organize it in Dhaka. And I said, look, you'll hardly get anybody. And he said, no, but it's so important because it's a Muslim majority country. So, and it's not one of the superpower countries either in any way. So people won't be able to dismiss it in the way they would dismiss it in New York. So those factors are also there. Which makes the act of building solidarity actually more complicated. And I think we're all asking ourselves these questions continuously.
What do you mean Marxist?
Sorry, louder.
What does it mean Marxist?
I don't know. What do you think it means?
Well, when I was in school, Marxism was related to a rise of industrialism. It's a different time related to the rise of industrial class, transitioning to the very economy. In today's world, how does that, and I'm not quite sure the context of Marxism. It's again focused on the cultures where people are transitioning from agrarian cultures to industrial cultures,
or industrial to hyper-industrial culture. Industrial to hyper-industrial culture.
Right.
And in places like Bangladesh, we haven't transitioned to industrial culture yet. So that transition, we're still in the middle of that transition.
Okay. So, so it's a traditional context of Marxism.
Traditional, but also shifted because capital has also changed tremendously and has moved more in a more agile fashion, which is why also parts of the left now in Bangladesh certainly very much focus on cultural projects rather than economic projects, because that they feel can motivate more people. So there's a tremendous amount of political organizing around cultural identity as well. Like, are we Bengali? Are we this? Are we that? Which I think in the 1970s, that those weren't even the conversations. It was straight up about mobilizing the villagers and mounting the peoples who are. So that context has very much changed. To get her the mic.
Can I get it? 5 months.
You're going to talk for a couple minutes, so you're going to take the mic.
Yeah.
Because it's recording as well.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, basically, it's just been 5 months in Bangladesh, and as you can probably tell from my accent, I'm not grown up there, so it was very much the first 5 months I spent there as an adult. And so, you know, going into a society like Bangladesh for 5 months, firstly, there were the war crimes trials going on. The war criminals from 1971, a small portion of them are currently being tried. So that was one very big thing going on that actually sort of sparked the Shahbagh protests. And so you had a young, secular, new generation of Bangladeshis kind of emerge at the heart of Dhaka at the Shahbagh Junction. And then you had like a counter-protest movement that sort of started off as Jamaat-e Islami, so a small group of Islamist, I guess a small group in Bangladesh. But then you had the Hefazat lot, who were sort of a much, much, much bigger madrasa based group, I would say, do a counter protest that looked very different to the Shah, you know, it was sort of the two Bangladeshes kind of colliding with each other. And then you had the Rana Plaza factory collapse, and 1,130 people died, and there's still hundreds of people who are missing. And oddly, when the Rana Plaza factory collapse occurred, heaps of the people mobilized through the Shahbagh protests and heaps of the people mobilized through the Hefazat protests all ended up at Savar in the rescue operations. And that was a really odd, weird moment to witness. If you were actually there, you actually saw the skull-capped young madrasa men and the, you know, large groups of the secularists from Shahbagh working kind of side by side to pull these bodies out. And then you had a tropical cyclone go through Bangladesh. It wasn't as big a tropical cyclone as they thought it was going to be. It was kind of a small tropical cyclone, but again, they're increasing, and Bangladesh is feeling the effects of climate change. It's one of the most vulnerable places to climate change. So after that 5 months, it seemed like a place that was kind of, you know, at the receive, it sort of represents crisis in global capitalism and industrial modernity or something like that. And in that context, what does a Marxist politics actually look like? It has to look like something that looks at the history of capitalism, that looks at what the forces are that are colliding in Bangladesh: nationalism, industrial violence, like just a whole range of things. And what one of the things that I wanted to ask you about, my observation goes to this question, is what do workers' movements have to do with this picture? Because this is what I went to Bangladesh expecting to find, and it's just what I didn't find. If you're politicized in Australia, that is what you know fights industrial capitalism. but, you know, I found that the people who call themselves Marxists, or the people who are the left, or would identify themselves as the leftists, are so incredibly divorced from workers' movements that it's just a little bit mind-boggling. Like, there was no working class people at all in Shahbagh, really, if you were there in the thick of it. That was very, very, very difficult to not
yeah, it was a very, very middle class politics. And so, yeah, I just wondered if you could talk about the actual composition, the people who are going to be, I don't know, who are leading left politics in Bangladesh.
I was hoping you'd end by saying, and that's what I have to say, not end with a question. I'm trying to figure out how I'm going to pull out a question from all of that. Did you just come back?
Yeah, fire.
Okay, great, great, of course. I mean, some of that was also probably super unfamiliar to people because I actually didn't talk about Shahbag explicitly, although the picture of the boy with the, or the man with the flag in his face is from Shahbag, but that's a whole other structure that I didn't talk about. I mean, I think, yeah, that part is definitely true, that that's a very middle-class movement or middle-class company, but that's not necessarily a surprise in Dhaka either, as a city which has a rising middle class, which is pretty significant, and, you know, left politics can come from mobilizing the middle class as well. I mean, I think the tricky thing, the thing that hams, the thing that paralyzes the left, at least in Bangladesh, and I'm not just thinking of Bangladesh, and I'm not here obviously to offer solutions about Bangladesh either, that's beyond anything I've thought about so far. It's more it's a utopian impulse in me that this is what I wish to happen, but if somebody asked me for a 10-point program, I don't have that. That's not what I've spent like the last couple of years preparing. But if I see the challenges, and this is where I think utopian imagining is necessary, the center and the center left today believes that the only way to mobilize large numbers of people is through religion. So it actually almost doesn't matter what your politics are. If you intend ultimately to either contest elections or build up a base in some other way, the assumption now is that somewhere in there, religion has to be in the front. And that is a change. And that I feel as a change in people's ability to imagine other possibilities. They've actually become more limited in what they can imagine in terms of how to mobilize people. And I think that, you know, one of the things I was thinking about a lot, so Shahbag, which was an anti-war crimes movement, but was also identified as a secular movement, mobilized maybe 500,000 people on the streets. The Islamists also mobilized maybe 500,000 or more. Maybe more. But the language with which people greeted the Islamist rally is very different. And even it shows in your words, in a way, you referred to the skull cap or the namaz tupi. So, you know, you're looking at it, and you might be right in thinking that pious men who had skull caps on are also Hefazat Islam members or Jamaat Islam members. You may also be wrong, right? Some of them might be pious and have no affiliation. But there's two things that go on now. Religious affiliation of a certain kind is automatically assumed to mean that you're with a certain side of the politics, which actually means that it is able to command a mind share that might even be larger than what it is, because if you project out that increasing piety automatically means increasing religious politics, you've already won half the battle. Then the second part of it that I notice is, even if the secularists get 500,000 onto the streets, and it's a gender mixed or crowd as well, which Hefazat Islam was not, it's 100% male, that 500,000 people is not considered significant. You are, in fact, one of the major things that happened, which is why I actually referred to Photoshop, there's this whole debate about how the images from Shahbag were Photoshopped, because there couldn't be 500,000 people there. But when there are 500,000 Islamists on the streets, broadly defined, no one ever says those images are Photoshopped. And I don't think either are, that's the thing. And when 500,000 secular protesters are on the street, it doesn't move people in the same way. It doesn't have the same affective power. It doesn't make people project out into an imagined strength that's nationwide. But when 500,000 or 750,000, whatever the number is, Islamists come on the street, people projected in Bangladesh that this is truly a new politics. And yet, those Islamist protesters were also not contesting elections, right? They were out on the streets for a specific issue, so were the secularists. One of the things that I've been thinking about is, why don't the secularists command the same kind of attention trepidation, and frankly, there's a little bit of fear in response to the Islamists, which translates into they, quote unquote, they, whatever that might, are so powerful that we have to change our politics so as to either appeal to them, mollify them, pacify them, incorporate them, or take that vote, which means that the entire politics is continuously moving towards slowly, gradually, and Islamist politics in various ways, whether it's through cultural signifiers or through specific political programs. And one of the things that I've been thinking about is how does the secular side command that same kind of hope? Like even in like Turkey, for example, the protests started. Within a week, you started hearing how these were very specific. They were not representative. You always hear they're not representative of the villages, they're not representative of the urban poor, etc. Maybe that's all true. It may absolutely be true. Maybe they're a slice. Maybe Bangladesh was also a slice. But the fact is, when it's secular politics, it seems people seem to be more able to say or suggest that this isn't a real movement. These people are out of touch. They're the city elite. You know, they represent a small group. They don't have a hold in the villages. They can't mobilize numbers at the election polls. But no one has, at least in Bangladesh, I don't know about Turkey, statistical evidence to necessarily back this up as much as they think they do. Maybe the numbers will prove me wrong. Maybe the numbers will prove that the Islamists do have that kind of force. One of the things that I've been thinking about, which was in my head a little bit when writing the talk, and will be in my head going forward, is if I believe in a secular and or left politics, and I know it's problematic to even blend those together, but just for the sake of shorthand, I'm doing it right now. How does that politics also command that kind of utopian impulse? Because one of the things that I see Islamist politics having is always an idea that our time is coming. It is our destiny in Bangladesh. We are supposed to ultimately run the country. And they transmit that to the population that they work with. And the secularists don't, and the left certainly doesn't transmit. In fact, the left's traditional burden, at least in Bangladesh, is that they were historic failures in 1970s and they shouldn't get another chance. You know, my father's generation is quite skeptical about the left. And so how to turn that around is something that I've been thinking about a lot. Not an answer, it's more sort of a continuing thing.
Two hands up. Thank you for this talk. This is really interesting, very thought-provoking, and I share your hope for the possibility of left secular politics globally in the global south. But I wonder whether I wonder whether focusing on this series of kind of spectacular public protests doesn't muddy the waters a little bit, and might be what's leading to some of your pessimism. And some of the uncertainty about these movements that you're talking about. And I wonder what it would do if you instead kind of shifted your focus to also think about organizational work and shift the scale a little bit. And I think I don't share your optimism about the Turkish protests right now. Friends, Kurdish friends who are there report that they're getting chased out of the square by the nationalists and by the secularists. But I wonder whether the Kurdish movement in Turkey might actually, in moving away from these spectacular protests, it might actually offer more hope. As far as I know, the PKK is the only solidly secular Marxist-Leninist organization in the world right now that has a largely Muslim base. Right? And they've been extremely successful, but they haven't participated in anything that's garnering the same type of media attention that these protests right now.
The PKK is also a terrorist organization that is an active war in South Turkey.
Yeah.
Cool. I don't know where you heard about that, but like my friends who are like in the square now are sitting with like Kurdish people, and they're saying that like the atmosphere is like Woodstock, and there's no party banners, and they're taking everybody who has a banner like out, and only like the youth groups are coming in, and they kindly ask to move out because they try to keep it as a passive process at the moment because they think that's the only way that the prime minister will hear their words. So like at the moment the square is clean, but in all the other cities it's getting politicized, and that's what I've been hearing from people.
Maybe everybody else with their hands up, because we're now less in questions, more comments. So.
And that's sort of connected, because I think there's a tension in your talk.
talk between solidarity and analogy, right? Because we can, I think there's a lot of value in thinking through the question of solidarity both across North and Global South lines, but particularly across third world or Global South lines, right? And that is, I think, a very rich conversation. But then there's the danger of drawing analogies between different struggles, which you are most familiar with the politics in Bangladesh, and you can speak to that in a particularly informed way, but the tension between comparing that to Iran, to Turkey, to etc., will draw out all the precise on-the-ground kind of minutiae that people are gesturing to right now. So I guess I'm curious as to whether the value of this utopian possibility is diminished by the necessary contingencies of things on the ground, right? And whether it's purely at the level of, I don't want to say rhetoric, I mean, I would say a dream even, but to the extent that it allows us to think about the politics of a case on the ground and what we would like to see within moments of reform. Because I think it's so interesting that between Shabag and Arab Spring and even Occupy Wall Street, everybody was taken by surprise, right? There was a sort of spontaneity and a sort of unpredictability about these events. But then when you looked at what they were able to do, they were only able, to the extent that movements were successful, it was by drawing on long-term organizing. So whatever groups had been doing all sorts of work in the years prior, those movements were either successfully or unsuccessfully able to capitalize on So it seems that even to the extent that we all come together and articulate a shared vision that is anti-national or global or transnational, it still doesn't seem to me that it will offer us that much in being able to capture on those individual moments that then produce actual structural change.
I think you know this already, but just to restate it, I wasn't suggesting that the situations on the ground in Turkey, Iran, Bangladesh, any of these places are the same. For the purposes of a description, the website says Muslim majority countries, but there's vast, vast differences between every single one of those examples, and virtually no commonality between a Bangladeshi person's experience on the ground in Dhaka and, let's say, somewhere like the United Arab Emirates, where they would be there as fourth-class citizens and deported for the disaster strike. So there, we know that there are multiple experiences, and there virtually no commonality, except, of course, to the extent that pious politics is also being exported. That is one commonality, and it's being exported through funding. That's one commonality. It's a line of connection. The reason to... Okay, so we're in Bangladesh, 2007, 2008, there was a military government, it was a very anti-politics time, then politics comes out, democracy comes back, democracy turns out to be not what we thought it would be, as it has every time a democracy has come back through elections. And in that moment, when we're looking for examples, right, the desire is always to find an example that will give you hope. And unfortunately, yes, going to your point, you are drawn to those spectacular moments. And I know that in myself, we all know that. And so, for example, when the Turkish movement started, the photographs are even more spectacular than Iran, let's say, because maybe Tumblr wasn't there in 2009, and now it, et cetera. And there are all these images that, give you hope, but yet you know they're photographed at a certain angle. You know that things may not be exactly like you said. Just like in Bangladesh, I would say the indigenous community will tell you that they found Shahbag deeply alienating because the slogan is, who are we, Bengali, Bengali. Well, they're not Bengali. And when they tried to raise that issue, they were also very... So there's always these things, and we know that. But I suppose part of the desire... So this is not a political program, obviously, because then you could not have such flattening conversations. But just in terms of... I know deep down inside that the Iranian movement was not an analog for Bangladesh at all, for example, and Turkey is not, and they're not for each other, and even they are not what they're projecting to the world, and what I'm seeing on the net is not what's really happening, etc. But just for a moment, you want, at least I want, to find just a little bit of something to hold on to, get a little bit of energy and optimism. Because otherwise, optimism is in very short supply, given the history. Like, just to stay with Turkey for a second, you know, if I just look at the recent history of strong states, by now, we can easily conclude that toppling states, I mean, you know, the few that happened during the Arab Spring now seem like something which will never be repeated. So then actually the lessons of history immediately send you into a mode of, well, I'm not going to get energized again because saw that happening. So part of what I've been trying to do, maybe more in the films and in this talk, is to not get into, like, the organizational details are of course very, very important. They're absolutely essential to build a political movement. You cannot, nobody should try to build a movement on the ground without that. But just for a moment to have a, and maybe it's a little bit of a, not a luxury, an opportunity, because we're physically right now not in the heat of that particular moment, that particular movement, trying to find something to get a little bit of hope. I mean, I said 30, maybe it's not 30, maybe it's 60. You know, maybe it will never happen. And I think so you both can give specifics about Turkey, I or she can give specifics about Bangladesh, anyone can give specifics that will contradict the hopeful idea. But part of the idea is, okay, what is there in there that can give you a little bit of motivation to do whatever it is you're going to do? Because I don't think everyone here or everyone in our lives is a direct political activist in those contexts anyway, right? We're engaged in all sorts of different projects that may not even be connected to direct politics. But something about the possibility of hoping for transformation is part of the reason why, you know, the work that I show or talk about is, and yes, I did choose the dramatic moment because I did, you know, I mean, when I was preparing the talk, I thought, by the end, I'll be so sad. Because that Iranian moment was a great moment for me, at least, and then it went away. You know, Ahmadinejad came, the rally, all of those things that they're talking about in the text messages happened, and yet it did not change those things. And so I wanted to come back to, you know, because this is ongoing, a little bit of hope, because in 3 weeks, 4 weeks, 5 weeks, 6 weeks, maybe things will have changed there as well. But I acknowledge completely that facts on the ground are completely much more complicated, and all of that was, you know, not referred to in the talk. Maybe comments rather than questions to say. Do you want to take the mic or something? I don't know if it'll reach.
So, that, I think. Great. And can you. Oh, okay. I think that last question was great, and I feel like, if I'm interpreting your answer correctly, you're kind of suggesting that the universal thing is this concept of hope, and or the thing that can be that applies or is significant in different contexts. And I know that not everybody was in the previous session, but I feel like there's a contradiction in your use of the concept. So in the earlier session, you were talking about the necessity of new energy and kind of the presence and movements of people who are rediscovering what you call, you know, hope for something different. And the conclusion of your presentation here actually seems to be, I mean, not optimistic. Like, actually, that what we can foresee is repetition and failures, and that right. So then the question, totally. I mean, I'm a Marxist too. The question is, what do you do to force things out of the pattern? And it's really unpopular to even ask the question, but the concept of hope figures prominently, and perhaps is incorrect. That is, I feel like there's a possibility that we're scared to tap into, that the premise, kind of at the outset of these like explosions of mobilization, the premise could be that we've already lost, and that could be something that would compel us to do something new, or have people be participating in a different way. So, I don't know. So I don't know if that's a question.
It's a good comment.
Okay.
Okay, and maybe we should end after your comment, but then we can also reconvene in the cafe downstairs if people want to continue the conversation in a warmer environment.
I feel bad. I kind of have a bigger question. I think you're kind of
wrapped up.
How are you seeing the different forces within Bangladesh responding to climate change, and how do you think Bangladesh will be? and how do you think Bangladesh will represent that issue on an international level, seeing that it's going to be most affected by climate change out of the majority of countries? And Maldives.
Was that really the question? Really? Okay.
Really?
Also, how can the new eco-Marxism arise in Bangladesh? Yeah, I just feel like that might take forever.
I'll just say one thing. Climate change in particular is, I think there's so many Bangladeshis that talk about that. Consciously, I don't want this to be recorded necessarily. I just have stayed away from that topic very deliberately. So that's why, I mean, I follow it, of course, but I almost feel that there are some topics where, of course, it's a huge issue, but it's almost assumed that on the international forum, I'm not saying that's your assumption, but in general, it's assumed that that's what we want to talk about always. And it dominates cultural work that comes out of Bangladesh, which is also fine, but it dominates a lot of things going on to the point where internally inside the country, it's almost like its own hegemonic discourse of this is what you're supposed to care about and not other things. So I just feel like my work goes somewhere else. Yeah, but it's an important issue, and hopefully we can all discuss it downstairs. Thank you everyone for staying here patiently. Thank you. Thank you, Alex, and the Triple Canopy team.
I put this away. But seriously, come join us for a drink downstairs if you like. If Naeem is still capable of speaking.